Icons and Semiotics of Human-Computer Interaction. Let's look at the history of icons. Where does this word come from? And it's a kind of old word. Was used firstly to describe Christian images painted on walls of Orthodox churches. And this is the oldest icon survived till now, coming from the 6th century. It's called Christ Pantocrator. Did you want to ask something?
Yeah, what is this icon?
What is this means?
Yeah,
Pantocrator, I don't know exactly what it means, but it's like Christ,
all creators.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah. Creator of everything, something like that. But look at what does the image, the icon means. If you separate, divide the images in by half, and then you duplicate it to the both sides, then you see clearly that one side of the face is one person, another side is another person. And then you can see that a good evidence that probably the intention behind this painting is to highlight the dual character of Jesus Christ as a God and as a man. Which side do you think it's the man?
Right.
Why?
I don't think so.
It doesn't have a book.
It doesn't have a book. What else more?
Yeah, but I don't think God studies.
No, he does not study, but he gives. God is giving the book to you, right?
Yeah, he has the knowledge.
He has the knowledge, yeah.
And his face is also heavier.
Heavier, right.
It's a strike of something. I don't know.
There's a
little
demon face here.
Demon face? Where?
Yeah,
No. Really?
There's a clown over here. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I don't think this was intended, but definitely the difference between the sides of the face was intended. And the main difference I see is that Jesus as a man is looking upwards, and Jesus God is looking downwards. And of course, this gives you a strange resulting image once the two of them are together, right? Now look, he looks like Strabic, right? Like he's done us strange, very strange. All right, so I said that this icon survived because there was an iconoclasm movement in the Byzantine Empire during the 18th century, and all of a sudden the leaders of this society, they said, well, those icons, they are being adored, they worshipped as if they were the real God, and they are not, and people are being misled into thinking that God is an image, so let's burn all this image, let's destroy all of them. That became known as iconoclasm movement. And that movement came because of a contradiction in society between representation and reality. That's a very old contradiction, and it haunts us until today. Every representation is not reality. But on the other hand, sometimes we need to get in touch with a reality that we cannot face directly. So we need representations. And in some sense, that representation becomes our reality. And we have so many of these activities. Think about today. I'm showing the example of the 18th century, where many of the activities of that time was organized around the church. And the church basically produced representations, if you look from a materialistic perspective. So the church had nothing real. If you look from that materialistic perspective. On the other hand, those representations, they really serve to organize the society and to make people do things together. And in that sense, they were real. And that's the contradiction. And in this particular image made by iconoclastic Byzantines intellectuals, they were saying that the artist, the guy in the bottom of the image, he's crafting an image of an icon of Jesus. He's doing something so cruel to Jesus as the guards, the Roman guards that were tempting Jesus while he was in the cross, while he was crucified. I don't know this thing. Crucified? I don't know. And why? Because now God in the image is restricted to the representation limits of the image, as much as he is restricted in his movements to stay in the cross. That was basically one of the explanations why sticking to images, God to images, was bad for the iconoclasm movement. And as I said, contradiction between representation and reality is still present today, and I think it's even stronger. Like this particular picture. So what does it say? Did I show it to you before or not?
Yes.
Already, right? So you have seen before. So what is the contradiction in this example?
It's just a drawing of the pipe.
But it's not a real pipe. But still, it's the only way we can talk about pipes here.
Talking about pipes is...
What?
Talking about pipe is already a contradiction, right?
Yes.
Because you're representing
the
pipe,
word pipe.
Word.
The word pipe is not a pipe.
Yes.
And even the movements in your mouth,
yes,
and the sound that comes through your mouth is not the word pipe. If you can go really far with that, the contradiction between representation and reality. If you look at that, it's impossible for humans to not have any representation. You cannot live a completely non-representational life. But on the other hand, you also cannot live a completely realistic life.
Yeah, but Fred, this is not what separates us and other animals, right?
Well,
we are able to do those kind of things to represent.
Some animals can too.
Some animals can understand symbols too. And work with representations.
But
on different levels of
that. Yes, but symbols that they create, right?
No, we can teach them that a symbol represents something.
And
okay,
smart animals.
But they do not have one thing: language. That's definitely a big difference. What is the difference between language and a particular sign? A language is an organized system of different signs. And it's a big difference because once you understand the language, you can acquire new signs. And that's the difference between animals and humans. Humans can have a dynamic language that's always changing and evolving, following the advancements in the culture, while animals do not have that. And they cannot transmit the advancements in their culture because they don't have language. So language is basically... from an evolutionary perspective, the main device that allows us to transfer all our knowledge to the next generations.
Yeah.
That's a very far-fetching claim, but it is true. But coming back to computers, computers in... another way can be understood as semiotic machines that we build to manipulate a lot of representations, a lot of signs. And we build computers because we have so many representations, and those representations are so different from our reality, and we must work with them because we want to reach a very distant goal. So we must stay back and stay with the representations for a while, and before we start really interfering with the world. That representation help us to to stay at distance to reality. And once you stay at distance to reality, we see that reality can be different. And we create a plan, we create very complex machines, and we send the man to the moon. So that's how it works. And we build computers because they are incredibly good for representation. First, we thought the computers were good for calculating. Calculation means working with numeric representations. But as we started to experiment with user interfaces, we saw that computers could represent other kinds of signs. And we worked with, beginning with computer science, we worked with a more complex formula that did not involve only numeric representations, but algebraic representation, which is a different one, and algorithmic representation. And now, after some years, with organization representations, like organizing a workflow for process for working. But even at the time, this is an example from the labs of Douglas Engelbart, the guy who created the mouse. This is the NLS system, the first one that used the mouse, you can see on the right. Still, those systems were very difficult to understand for a person who didn't have a mathematics or engineering background. And they were abstract. They were not concrete. Abstract and concrete is always depending on the person or the culture that person is part of. This might be very concrete for engineers and mathematicians because they really work on a daily basis with abstractions of this type, and as you do that, it may become concrete to you, but it's abstract for a person who does not have the same background in that field. In order to bridge this gap, this abstraction gap, a guy called David Smith, he studied the history of arts, and he really was an open-minded guy. In the 75, he was also from Stanford, and he thought, why don't we have little images in the computer that represents computational concepts? And if you do that, people will understand much more if you just give a name to them, like in the previous command line interfaces, that prompt command line interface that they had at that time. And this was the birth of, or actually the dawn of the graphic user interface. He created the name icon to this computer representations, and he created a language, a visual programming language, I think it was the first one, that stated, like, you can see what he meant by icon is not exactly what we mean by icon currently. For example, those two arrows coming from the why question, they are a representation, the icon of if structure. And you could draw them on the screen and execute a program, a calculation, for example, if you wanted. But inspired by his work, Tim Mott and Larry Tesler, working at Xerox PARC, they created the desktop metaphor. We already spoke about it in the first lecture. And they created this metaphor based on the office culture. It's a metaphor of objects that people who work with computers might be familiar with. So people already know how to move around an office and deal and manipulate objects in the office. So they may bring this knowledge to the computer. If the computer represents its workings like if it was a virtual office somehow. So this was the first sketch they drew on a napkin, back of a napkin, and became so important for the history of human-computer interaction. This is the first computer icons in the Xerox Auto in graphic user interface, the first graphic user interface that used icons, to put it another way. And as you can see, they represent very simple computational concepts. They represent files, and they also represent folders where you have files inside. Folders, in a technical term of the time, is called directory. So that's what a folder is. A folder is actually a file that has a list of other files. That's what technically is a folder. So it's not a folder, it's not different from a file. But in order for the person to understand that you can have files inside folders and not files inside files, that they made this difference in the representation. So a folder behaves differently than a file. And it's also represented through a different icon. And also at Xerox PARC, they created the first icon family, different icons for a more complex system, which was the Xerox Star. We also saw the Xerox Star advertisement in the first class, showing that they had intention, the Xerox Star, to support a decision-making workflow in an organization. So they have more a lot of different objects that are in an office, and they didn't know if the presentation would be understandable by the users, so they tested. They showed for different versions of the same icon which one represents this. This was one of the early attempts to do usability testing, which we also saw in the last class. But user interface icons really became popular by the Mac, through the Macintosh launch in 1984. And those icons, they are called iconic today because they are like, they really speak a language. They have this isometric perspective. They have very simple shapes. They really exploit pixel art as if it was not a bad limitation of the medium, but really as a good feature. And Susan Carter, she was a graphic designer. She never worked with computers before. She really put a lot of effort into making them emotionally affecting the user, so the user will see himself in those icons and identify with the icons. And the icon that really express this intention is the Macintosh, the computer icon on the corner top left. He's looking at you with his friendly face and telling you, look, through these icons, through myself, you can understand the computer and do some productive work. Apple is definitely the company pushing forward the development of icons. And in 2007, Steve Jobs launched the first product, physical product made out of icons. See, what the fuck? No, the iPhone has hardware. It's not made of icons. Yes, but what does it stand for? The physical thing stands for icons. That's all you see on the computer, on an iPhone screen. There's nothing else. There's no other elements attracting the attention other than these icons. And those icons, as we also saw in another class, they helped selling the iPhone. And recently, last year, Apple also launched Animojis, which are icons that mimic your facial expressions in real time. And in this particular moment, I was there at the WWDC and seeing this guy presenting.
You were there?
I was there, yeah. And he was presenting. He first tried to present it, but it crashed. The system crashed because he was trying to unlock the screen, and the screen crashed. But no problem, he recovered. And then he made a representation of how could we use emojis to make funny faces. And he's the head of engineering at Apple. And it was so funny to see this guy soltando a franga. Really, really funny. So why icons are so important to human-computer interaction because, first of all, they relate abstract concepts to concrete experiences. I don't know what a folder in a computer means, but I know what a folder does in the real world. And I can put things inside a folder. I know that. But one strange thing from the computer folders is that you can put a folder inside a folder. And if you do that in the real world, you get a jumble because it's so many. It will not work. At some point, you will not be able to put folders inside folders. But you can do that in the computer. All right, but that's not a problem because actually it's always good if you can do more with computer icons. Then the problem comes if you can do less. For example, if I know how to do something with an object and that object you cannot do in a computer, that's a bad icon somehow because it does not use my concrete experience. Icons are also mnemonic, so they are easy to memorize and to recognize in the interface. You can even remember, you may not remember completely in your mind what is the drawing, what is the precise drawing. If I ask you now, draw for me what is the shape of the delete button of your favorite operating system, you may not know, but if I show you and ask you what is this icon means, you recognize it. And that might be more easy than to understand what does the word delete means. Even there are some people that doesn't know what delete means in a computer and still they erase files from their computers. Icons are easy to find. So you can search around, they draw attention. They save screen space. You can tell a lot of things through icons that will take a lot of words to explain the same way. And it's also good for internationalization because you don't need to translate icons most of the times. You only need to translate icons if they use human hand gestures. For example, this one, if you push forward an app with this icon to people in Iran, they would laugh, of course, because this means... No, I don't. Wouldn't tell, but it's really, really bad words. Yeah, and
it's called in China.
It's also strange in China. So you can see that already why Facebook has some trouble in these places. All right, so last but not least, icons also have a lot of emotional bounds, like the emojis especially. Let's look at the anatomy of an icon. What are the components of an icon? Icon has a predominant color. That's the first thing you see. This is a green icon. Yeah, you see the lightning on top left corner most of the time, and a border, sometimes no border. The icon somehow suggests an action. If you press the icon, you get a result, and it's trying to show you with a line the difference, the threshold between the green, the light green, and the darkest green, is telling you that there will be an action of trying to search for your iPhone. There is a label, a figure, and a background in the border, or sometimes in the interface itself. And I show you the anatomy because I want to really to draw attention to the memorization and recognition process. They work in the opposite way. Once you see for the first time an icon, you see a complex image. And as you look at the icon, in a matter of some seconds, you decompose the icon into its distinctive features. And some people go deeper, some people just stay on the first phase, so you just look at the distinctive feature, but some people might really remember and the color and the overall shape. Those are the most important characteristics that people would memorize. And as you see, look for an icon, actually, you might lose the distinctive feature because what sticks to your memory is more like the color or the shoulder shape. And you are looking for something that similar to that shape or either something that has that color. And once you see, you reconstruct it in a matter of seconds again to see if it matches your internal representation of the icon, what you're looking for. This is very difficult to study from an empirical perspective, because those processes, those cognitive processes, are not easy to observe. They happen in the brain. They do not happen in the physical world. So it's difficult to understand. So this is basically hypothetical, okay? But the most important part of the icon is, what does it mean? So why does a friend of mine called Everardo Coelho, he worked for Apple for a time and he designed this icon. Why did he put this icon to represent finding your phone? Because this means radar. It's a radar. Radar are military a technology that, like many other technologies of the military, developed by the military, now is part of your home. So somehow you're using military technology in your daily basis, and it's also related to the you're worried about being stolen, and vigilance, and people are being surveilled. Actually, that's not vigilance word; it's surveillance, and parents that are worried where their sons are, so they use this Find My iPhone. To find where your son is. If the son did not allow you to do that, so it's not fair. But Apple gives you two options to survey your kids: the ethical option, where your kids have to comply and say, "Yes, mom, I give you permission to see where I am," and the Find My iPhone version, which does exactly the same. But not without your agreement. And it's so funny. Why did Apple choose that? Because those parents, they're hypocritical. They do not really want to be criticized for being surveilling their kids. But there should be, if it was an honest icon, surveil my kids. That should be the name of the app, right? Find My Friends. Nobody uses this for their friends. The only users of this are parents, really. This application is used by parents, not by friends. All right. As I told you, my main frame of reference to semiotics in HCI is the semiotic engineering approach of Clarice Sequenes de Souza. And the theory is based on two main claims: that computers are sign processing machines, and the interface, specifically user interface, is a communication process based on signs. Let's look at some models to understand the theory. This is the model in the article I ask you to read, and it describes the meta-communication according to semiotic engineering. It happens like this. The designer, who is far away from the user in a different context, non-situated, as she put it, he codified a message about how the computer works. And this message is implemented in the interface, and the interface will provide information to the user, so the user understands the message. The user will also code some information back to the message, and the message would react to the user, creating a kind of a meta communication. The message is talking back to the user what does the computer does, because it cannot tell everything the computer does at once, because the user will be, of course, overwhelmed. It only tells in parts, little parts, the message. So this is the basic idea behind semiotic engineering. Let's see an application of meta-communication concept to a very important feature, a very important part of user interface design. And a big problem I face myself at Apple Developer Academy, software studio that produces a lot of mobile apps. Most of my students, they are not able to do strategic meta-communication. They do operational meta-communication, if they do any meta-communication. If you do not do much matter communication, do not pay attention to that, you write a computer user interface message that explains the computer as you understand, as a computer programmer. So you write basically a documentation of your algorithm. But if you think about what the user will understand and how we will understand how to use the icons of the interface, then you are using the the operational meta communication level. Here, you build help files, you build some labels, telling people where to click, how to operate this system. But you do not tell why. This is the biggest hurdle I have. Students do not communicate. Why should the user use this application in the first place? What is the benefit? What are the advantages? What can I get in my life out of this application? And here you see an example of 500 pixels application telling you how to use it. But do you know what 500 pixel application is? You don't. But if you didn't know, you would not be able to use the application at all because it will not tell you. You have to try to see. But Airbnb, once you if you install for the first time, the application will tell you, look, Airbnb is all about providing you great experience of hosting, being hosted in other places. It's not telling anything about the app itself. It's telling about the service. And as you understand the service, then you can start understanding the app, the user interface. Because the user interface exists because of the service, not the other way around. And that's difficult for computer programmers to understand because they think that their reason for their existence is to produce code. While in this case, I'm showing you that code is just a medium for a message that comes from somewhere else. The message is the service that people are trying to communicate. And that's more important for the success of the startup than the app, than actually how does the code works. I know it might be difficult sometimes for computer programmers to accept that what they are doing is not really the final result, not really the end result. That's not the reason why we started the whole thing. But actually, it's become much more productive and interesting if you see your work as a means to an end. And the end might be much more motivating than the means itself. So in semiotic of human-computer interactions, designers are translators of programming languages to interactional languages. Once I say designer, I'm not telling that a designer is a person who studied design in grad school or undergrad school. That means that any person can be a designer. It's just a role. The designer translates the programming language into interactional languages. On the back window, on the bottom window, you can see code representation. And here you can see how does it represent the functionality? How does code is represented through a graphic user interface? And that's what the designer does. He tries to convey the message, the functionalities, the possibilities offered by the code. Those are the main differences between those two languages. Programming languages instruct the computer. Interactional languages enable users to communicate. It does not instruct the user. Look, there's a difference between instructing and enabling. Enabling means that the user might communicate also. He might also say things to the computer. And the computer might also say something back. That's what an interaction is about. Programming, the code is defined by a few. The people that are language designers, they define what the code will be. But in an interactional language, a lot of people are defining the code because everybody is using the computers in different ways. These different ways affect the way the computer is developed in the long run. For example, hashtag in Twitter. This was created by users, not by Twitter developers. Later on, Twitter developers said, look, this is cool. Users are using hashtag a lot. Why don't we make it official and make a functionality for finding hashtags, for putting hashtags into Twitter tweets. And this interactional language, hence, that was developed by the users and later on codified by the programmers. Programming languages are formal in a way that they can be understood and interpreted by a computer. Not really understood, but really executed by a computer. While interactional languages are informal, and there's a lot of meaning that the computer cannot capture. And programming languages express computational concepts, while interactional languages express very different concepts from different fields. Interaction design patterns are the basic units of the interactional language, and this will be the topic of our next class. So get to read, because we're going to go deep into that. But coming back to icons, icons are sometimes interpreted as part of this interactional language. They are not just words, they are not just isolated elements in a screen. They are complete sentences. They tell you a lot more than you expect. Look at this example, Firefox Crystal, an icon created by my friend Everaldo Coelho. If you use phrasal structure analysis to decompose what this icon is telling you, what does it conveys, you can see that icons also have structures. For example, I wrote down, I interpreted this icon as telling me, you can navigate the web as fast as a Firefox. Right? That's what he's telling. And where are these elements there? So you is always the user. The icon's always telling the, talking to the user. Where is the navigate the web? So there is this world, small little world with some connections. And the way you navigate this world is fast, because it's showing you that it's so fast that it's burning out, like you, and it's leaving behind some tail of a fire. And where this tail of fire comes from, a fox that's made out of fire, a fire fox. So that's all what an icon tells you in a fraction of seconds. It's much quicker than text to convey that. But the text is good to analyze and understand that. And every icon has this structure, the subject, verb, adverb, predicate, and adjective, much like the written language. And the subject is always the user. I can do this, I can do that, or you can do this, you can do that. And do is a verb, and the adverb qualifies the verb. What do you do? You do something to change something else. That's the predicate, the object. And the adjective tells you what's the quality of the object after you did the action. So what are the consequences of your action? So what is the subject here? The user, right? Yeah. And you, it's the you word. What's the verb? Can and navigate. It's the G over there, VVV. And then you have the now then you have then you ha- no then you have the predicate. No, actually the. Yeah, the predicate, the objects. So you can navigate what? The web. And then there's adverbs saying as fast. So it is telling you a qualification of your can navigate as fast. Adverbs. And there's a proposition that's also make a connection between the two. And then there's an article A and a noun, Firefox. So it makes an analogy between the adverb fast and Firefox. Of course, this is very tiring, and you don't need to do this kind of analysis to create new icons. You just need to understand that icons operate in a language. That's the main important part. And as you write a text, you do not the same. When you're writing a text, you do not think about all of these rules of the language. You just write. And then people will understand or not.
How does it work? You build a phrase like this, and then you think about how it's going to be the icon? Or, I don't know.
How... Well, look. Well, look. Everaldo Coelho, he didn't do this, right? I'm doing this.
Okay.
I made analysis. And he's never doing analysis like this for creating icons. I just did this for a pedagogical example for you to understand that the icons tells you much more than what you just see in a quick glance. All right? And you do not need to use this method. But if you are interested in this method, and of course there will be possibly very interesting scientific applications for this, you can look at this application, Visual Interactive Syntax Learn. It can be used also for natural language processing research, not just for icons. All right. Standard iOS toolbar and navigation bars icons, they have verbs, but they do not have predicates. They do not tell which kind of object is going to be changed once you press play. You press play into what? And then you see, where do you get the information about the object that this play is oriented towards? How do you get this information?
The point?
No. Look, I have an app, I'm an interface, and there is this icon. How do I know that this play icon refers to the music track that I have opened in my app?
Because
because of the context. The position in the app will tell me what does this do. Of course, I could put a sign like this, play what, and I put an arrow. I put an arrow saying play what, play this. But this might be more confusing. You don't need this information because it's already said by the context. And a lot of things I'm telling you right now is also already said to you in the previous classes. So I do not need to tell you again. But you understand because this information is already in the context. So get from this message that you do not need to draw everything you want to convey or mean through an icon. Because a lot of meaning might come from the context where you put this icon. And also the icons that are next to that icon. So if you see a toolbar, you understand that all those different icons, they refer to the same object. And those are the different actions you can take to change that same object. And that's why you may be very simple in your icons in a toolbar, because the only thing that they need to convey is the difference between them and not exactly the individuality of each icon. Now you see a different example, where you have implicit verbs with multiple predicates. It's the opposite. Now the verb is not there. You do not know what do you do if you press most recent or recent or search button. But, well, actually search is a verb. But top rated, near me, top chats, most of them are implicit verbs. Right? The verb is basically show me. Yeah, show me or open, right? And the object is what changes for each of these icons. If you look at the home screen, the icons predicates have too many adjectives. So you see very colorful, very detailed icons because the goal is to express the experience qualities. Because the home screen, as I said before, helps to sell new iPhones. So it has to give you an overall feeling of the experience of that new iPhone and that new iOS system. And if you look coldly to these icons, they do not tell anything about what they do. For example, look at the settings. Look at the music. Game Center. What does Game Center do? You cannot understand what does Game Center do by the icon, right? The message one is a good one because it tells you can say something through the message. There is an action there. But most of these icons do not have an action, and does not have a verb, because the goal of these icons is to express the experience qualities of a whole application. They want to, once you draw an icon that represents an application, the main icon of an application, you have to think very carefully what you're going to represent there, because that's going to stand for a lot of work you have done, and it has to be related to a benefit and seduce the user, because in the App Store you have billions of billions of apps, and if you see one of these apps you might want to download if the icon itself is already tempting, it seduces you, it suggests an interesting experience. So at Apple Developer Academy we put a lot of emphasis into that, because Apple told us that this is the drawing line between a good app and a bad app. Purchases and downloads numbers comes from the icon design. People using the App Store, they mostly don't read taxes. They just look at the icon and evaluate if that app really does what they want.
And the number of stars.
Yes, exactly. Which is another icon, by the way. So icon languages should employ verbs, nouns, and adjectives in a consistent manner. And Spotify is currently the best example I know so far. It's so simple and so consistent. All the strokes in those icons, they have a consistent width. Width. Stroke width. So same size, about the same size, same proportion, same angles of the curves, right? And you see an icon and you immediately recognize that this icon is part of a family because they are so similar. And that definitely provides you an overall feeling of the experience of the app. It's very distinctive. However, the formal variation is also important for an icon language. Like if you make all the icons so similar to each other, a person might take a lot of time to distinguish the differences. So it's good if you give a different shape, a distinctive shape to each icon, even if that's just not conveying any meaning. It's just for the formal reasons, for the differentiation. All right, guys. I think we may finish this topic. Let's dive deeper into semiotics. This is not even in Clarice's article I told you to read, so it might be difficult to follow. But let's analyze how icons work. Using the Charlie Sanders piece, who is a guy who founded semiotics in the beginning of the 1900s years, Pierce proposed that the sign has three elements, so that's why it's a triad. The sign represents something, right? And something is the object. So what does this icon represent? A hard disk data. This is the object. The representation is called representamen. That's a Latin word for representation. A folder in Finder represents hard disk data. But once you see a particular folder, once you see a folder in a computer that you know the computer, you do not get the meaning that this is a folder. You get the meaning that this is my photo album folder. It's my specific folder. I know it. So that's the interpretant. Interpretant, it is the result of that representation of that object in a particular context. But semiotics is complicated because you never do this sign acquisition alone or in a particular moment. You do that in a process, ongoing process, an infinite process of unlimited semiosis. Because one icon leads to another icon. One sign leads you to another sign. So here you see the folder and you know that this is a photo album. But once you know it's a photo album, You might remember that you wanted to print that album, and that folder becomes a representation of the printed album, and then you send to the printer, and the printer becomes a representation of a gift you want to give to someone, because you remember that you want to print it to give to someone who never saw those pictures or who wants to see that picture, like your grandma, and that person is not being able to access those pictures because the grandma does not know how to use a computer. And that process of thinking about your life is actually an Elamitic semiosis. And you say, how do you may ask, how do you study that? Well, it's very difficult, I would say, difficult. You may only study Elamitic semiosis through speculation. Speculation in a specific context based on information of who are the users in that particular case, what is the repertoire of different meanings those icons have, and so on. It might not be a very empirically validated concept, but might be interesting to see and predict potential interruption of the semiosis, which is known as breakdown. We already saw this term in the last class, cognitive engineering, where breakdown is once you have an expectation, that expectation is not mapped by the interface, then you break down the flow of your cognition. And in the semiotic engineering, they explain why. Because the sign represents something, another object. You thought that the sign, the representamen, would be connected to that object, but the representamen is connected to another object. And then once you see the interpretant, the results that do not match what you expect, then you might create a new sign and understand, learn a new sign. But here, you learn something that you do not like. You learn that Photos app in the Macintosh does not really send, order photo album books to Brazil. And you may only learn that after you build a whole photo album, spend hours selecting which photo to put in. And that's quite bad. So they should have an icon or some kind of visual information or written information once you start building your album that you are not be able to print it in Brazil. So that's why it's useful to use this concept of Elamitic semiosis. And you can also use the concept to follow our cognitive interaction with a system. For example, from the moment the person is having trouble to the moment that the person gives up using the application, those are called communicability expressions, and they are used to differentiate between different types of breakdowns. And this is also developed by De Souza and colleagues from the semiotic engineering HCI branch. And it's a very interesting, very cool way of looking at usability data, usability test data. So you record a user using a particular interface, and you look at the moment that user is thinking, what should I do? Or you look to the face of the user. And sometimes the face of the user matches those faces here. And then you know that most of the problems, usability problems that the person has in a computer might be just because the person does not have find help, the person don't know where things are, or if the problems are more severe, the person makes an error and does not know that the error has been done. For example, erasing a file that person does not want to erase, and later on not finding the file and becoming really desperate about the for the lack of that information. It's a very interesting approach for usability engineering, this specific communicability expressions. I have used that for some of my usability test studies, and they are quite, I think this is the most useful so far tool that came out of the semiotic engineering research I found so far. And this is another example of semiotic interruption, semiosis interruption, but showing you that the reasons why there is the interruption. For example, the designer didn't want to design a new icon just for ejecting a DVD. So the designer thought, why not associating the trash can icon with the DVD? So the trash can icon, if you mix them both, if the trash icon represents the DVD, then you have an eject button. And then the trash icon changes, is replaced by eject icon. And then we can save some space screen on the computer. And the user might understand something completely different, that the eject icon represents that you're going to trash this DVD-ROM. The DVD-ROM will be erased forever. But that's not what the designers wanted to convey. So, for example, in here, the user sees the eject icon, and he thinks that the DVD will be trashed. So the object of DVD will be transformed into an interpreter, which is trash, which is erased. And this is the reason why these things happen, is misplaced relationships between object and representation, but also noise, unclear messages, or even the receiver's lack of repertoire. For example, this problem is still today in Macintosh OS interfaces. It's a very old usability problem that many people have written about, but Apple still wants to stay in this way because it's traditional. Everybody knows that you have to put the DVD or the disk icon into the trash if you want to eject, because there's no eject button to Macintosh computers. All right, but people that start doing that for the first time, they really get confused. So why not change that? Because Apple does not want to change that. There is not even a disk drive or a DVD drive any longer. So why care about this? So users are like that too. They don't know, don't care. In my view, semiosis is most of the time interrupted, not by noise, not by bad design, but people are really not interested into that interface. They do not pay attention because that is not useful at all. Interest, motivation, does not come from the looks of the icon. It does not help you if you draw a very beautiful icon. That will not interest the user. It's not even the computational concepts the icon represents, which is the domain of semantics. But really, what is possible to do with the icon is really what interests the users. This is pragmatics. Those are three dimensions of language: syntax, semantics, and pragmatics, that semiotics is all about. Most of the time, people think semiotics is only syntax, like once we decomposed the phrase, we will only look at the syntax. But semantics is all about what does it mean in our language. But people want to mean in language, to have meaning, because they want to do things in the world. Language is used for doing things, and doing things is the realm of pragmatics. It's a big, huge conversation in computer science, syntax, semantics, and pragmatics. Most people will argue that computer science is only concerned about syntax. But I would argue that computer scientists most should look at pragmatics, because computers are used for doing things in the world, and it should be viewed in that way. And here there's an example of a comic strip of Garfield looking at an app, and Garfield's so-called girlfriend, she asks him, "What are you doing, Garfield?" And he answers, "Looking at pictures of food on my phone." And she says, "Ah, romance. You got it right, lady." And so if you do not know the history of those two characters, you might not understand the joke, because she's only tempting Garfield, and she's only trying to get closer to him. He does not pay attention to her. He's only concerned about food. And here he looks like he's very interested in other people, like looking at Facebook page or something like that. But no, he's just looking at the picture of food. And this picture is also funny because it shows that people are ignoring each other in the real world to look at not so relevant things like pictures of food. And there's a lot of layers of meaning being conveyed through this simple pictorial example. And this is pragmatics. This is about not reading the syntax of the language, not even the semantics of each element, but really the final result of the whole thing. That's pragmatics. And pragmatics explains why emojis are the most popular icons in the computer. They do not represent any computational concept. Of course, you may look at how many emojis people are using and so on, but really, they do not represent anything in the computer. They really only represent something in the discourse of people talking, in the emotions people feel in the world. And icons are increasingly representing non-computational concepts. Therefore, they are perceived as such, subject to the contradictions of society. In particular, that one I spoke to you about before, between representation and reality. So, for example, into iOS 10 and iOS 11, there was a major change in the address book icon. Before, there was only a shape, a silhouette of a man, and now there is a shape of a man and a woman, and the woman is in front. And this is definitely not a formal change to make the icon look prettier. Not about that. It's all about the women's fight for representation, being represented in society, being recognized in society. If there is a lot of women in the address book, because people speak to women, we have at least 50% of people who are women in our world, why do we have 100% representation of men? Why not having men and women? So this icon is, of course, subject to a political debate of women being represented. I'm raising this question, but I noticed that change. But most people do not even notice the change unless you are a woman. And you might look at, wow, now I'm really represented here. But in the future, maybe people might think that man and woman is also a representation of a traditional family and so on. There will be other debates in the future that Apple will have to face if they keep this icon like it is. So what I mean with this whole with this example is that icons are not they are increasingly being understood as part of our human world and not part of the computer world, where you can construct a completely consistent system with one representation closing the loop to another. Icons are part of our human world, and they abide to our rules that are not really fixed and not really clear.
Right.
Yes?
Just bringing some crazy thoughts to the table. Sometimes icons stop representing real objects or actions or something like that, and then they start representing the same icon but in an evolutionary way. And for example, I make the first mobile phone icon just like the mobile phone, and then the second one I take some details, and the next one is just a square, and everybody knows it's a mobile phone because, and then you take off the square. When icons evolve, there's like the possibility of they don't represent anything else anymore, just the icon.
Just the memory.
Yeah. You are spoiling my presentation, but I'm gonna explain why this. Just hold on, all right? We are gonna explain this in three slides. So now we're gonna really go deep into engineering. It's semiotic engineering. Actually, not even semiotic engineering has reached that far. I developed this research many years ago once I was reading semiotic engineering. I'm not reading that in the last year, so I'm not so much understanding what is the state of the art, but I suspect that people do not have a clear picture of these things like I do. and with these examples, but still it's difficult to understand. Charles Sanders Peirce said that icons can be classified into 10 different types. And I will provide you 9 types, because I think that those are the consistent types. There's one type that is really crazy to understand from Peirce, and I will not give you any example, just not to confuse you. And Peirce says that the differences between those types are based on the relationship between the representamen and something else. And the first else, something else, is the representamen itself. So the relationship between the representation and the representation. There are 3 possibilities in each of these types. The first possibility is that the icon represent has a quality that represents its icon. So the icon represents the quality of being an icon. It's crazy, right? So what is this? Can you recognize what does this icon represents? A lot of what?
A box of games.
A box of games, yeah.
It's a folder, right?
No?
It's something for fixing the hard drive.
Almost. This is a box full of icons. It's an icon of icons. And what is distinctive about this icon? The quality of iconicity. So you look at this icon and you see icon in its most essential form. All right? So the icon represents an icon.
Why does it have the arrow though?
The arrow is just like boxes. Sometimes they say this side up, right? It's just to characterize the box. It doesn't have any function. And this icon is used in the Ubuntu distribution for customizing icons of the operating system. And if you look at what is the object? It's the same. It's an icon, representation of an object, icon, right? And that's why the quality of iconicity is the most important feature of this icon. But here you see something different. The representation is related to itself by a particularity, because each emoji is different from another emoji. Every time I see an emoji, I see a particular face in a particular moment of time, a person looking at the computer. So there is a particularity. Here, the same sign, I don't know if that's the right pronunciation for this word. The same sign represents the expression of a particular person. So the quality, the particularity, the os trejeitos, in Portuguese to say, are depicted by this icon. And that's why they are so funny. Because you look at the icon and you see a person. You see a person because you are used to look at a person and recognize that person's behavior by its movements of the eyes movements, the movements of the head. Every person has these particularities. And once you transfer that to another kind of shape, and still the os trejeitos, they are there, then you really draw attention to those trejeitos.
Traits.
Thanks. So you really notice those traits. And that's what a scene sign does. It represents particularity. In this case, traits, human traits. Or person traits, actually. And the legend sign is when the representation is a law. It represents itself. It represents itself in a way that stands for a law. It's always like this. Legend sign means beware. You're going to push this and the computer will shut down. And it's not like trying to show, to represent something else. It's just trying to show you, this is an order, right? You're going to press this button, you're going to switch off. And it's really like almost like a warning. What?
Advice.
An advice. Yeah. So it's representing a law. Now let's look at a second example, and that will explain Doria's question. Now let's analyze representation, the relationship between representation and object. What does it stand for? There are three possibilities: similarity, causality, and arbitrary. Once there is a similarity between the icon and the object it stands for, then you can say it's an icon. Really, the word computer icon is used without this distinction, right? But now I'm using icon for a specific category of Peirce types of signs. And he says that iconic signs are the ones that have some similarity, visual similarity to the object. Here you can see a calculator, because you see the distinctive features of the calculator. It's similar to a physical calculator. That's why you call it an icon. But this object is not really similar to what it represents. The object is the day. What is a day? It's so abstract. There's no similarity between this and the day. And actually, what is it represent is that there is a new day. It's 17th of July, so you have to do something. It's indexical. Indexical, or index, means that there's a cause and effect relationship between the representation and the object. And here, representation is an icon that changes every day. So there's a effect relationship between the day. So that yesterday or 16th of July, then the icon will be 16th of July. The representation is different. If you look at this example made by Nadan, he's a very didactic person. He explains how from this old old way of representing icons in the beginning of the computer science, people started to build very realistic icons, trying to be more like the real world and more detailed. And here they became more simplified, essential, right? In the index, you show the result of the calculations. So you make it clear what happens once you use the icon in a computer interface. And symbolic is when you look at the most the parts of the images that are recognized everywhere, even out of context. For example, the X. This is does not represent precisely the multiplying function, but represents the whole calculation, the whole calculation possibilities of a calculator. This is symbolic, and the symbolic can easily become a convention, and you forget where it started in the beginning. And then you have this strange feeling that you are living on top of representations that do not represent anything, because the object it was used to represent in the past is forgotten. For example, the word A. What's the relationship between the word, not the letter, A? What's the relationship between A and the mouth sound of A? A. Is this like a triangle? No. We don't know the A triangle with the... So our alphabet is not based on the mouth representation, because the same alphabet is used by different languages. But there are some alphabets, for example, the... what's the name? The Korean alphabet, that tries to represent the mouth movements for the noises, the sounds that come from your mouth if you speak that letter.
It's easier.
Easier to learn, but more difficult to express complex things. If you try to mix different sounds into one word, not a letter, but a word, might be difficult to look slowly to which kind of movement what you need to do. You see? So abstraction helps us with that in our alphabet. So our alphabet is symbolic. It takes more time to understand the convention, but once you get it, you operate in a symbolic world. And that symbolic world, you operate much faster and much more cognitively functional. It's much more efficient. But you can say that you also lose the contact with our concrete experience. And for example, if you need to learn a new language, you might have a hard time understanding the pronunciation. You have the alphabet to read the new words of that new language, but you use your framework of a previous language pronunciation to try and say things in that new language. So your concrete experience is fundamentally flawed because you have not concrete experience with that language mouth operations. And to undo what you have learned takes a lot of time. If you have learned from zero, ground zero, if our alphabet was not so abstract, you won't have learned much faster the other language. So there's always some drawbacks into semiotics. Any questions about this? Did you get your answer?
Yes.
Cool. And the last example, the last three types, make a relationship between representament and interpretant. Interpretant is what happens once you acquire the sign, the whole sign. What happens after? What are the consequences of that icon? There are three possibilities. Certainty, I'm sure this will happen. A fact, I'm seeing this happening. And possibility, might happen, might not. And then if you look from the certainty perspective, you see an argument. So this is the interface of Siri in the iPad, I think, or in the Mac. And Siri is making sure that she's listening. Go ahead, I'm listening. She's providing you an argument. It's making a relationship between representation and interpretation. You may be sure that I'm going to listen what you say. She does not say, I'm going to understand you. But she's listening. Then, once you see the button here, you see a possibility, right? A possibility that she might understand you. That's a rim. I don't know how to pronounce it in English. The descent is this. It's this actual visual representation of what you are saying to Siri at that particular moment. It's the frequency analysis. But why do we have this representation here if the analysis of what you're saying is not completed? Why? Why do Apple designers put a wave form of the speaking at that time?
To give you feedback that it's really happening.
Yeah, it's really happening. It's to make you, to show you there's a fact. It's not just an argument. She's not just trying to make sure that this is happening. It's really a fact. We are receiving your audio feed. But you do not know what are the possibilities, right? So that's why those three icons, those three types of signs are here. All right, I know this is complicated, but imagine that you may combine all of these nine types to generate thousands of possibilities. That's what Merkle's thesis is about. That huge diagram at the end, I think it has 48,000 options. This is like what you get if you multiply rem versus descent and argument in each of the icons. So you have a descentic rem argumentation. And you have a quali-legis rem sign. So I didn't get that far. I don't understand fully Merkle's thesis. I just got this part, and I'm fine with that. And another insight I got from reading comics, and this is not really Pierce's insight, it's really like a practical insight from Scott McCloud. He has a very cool book called Understanding Comics. It's actually the best book on semiotics you can read as so far. He says that representations, they can be closer to the object or closer to the interpretant. Closer to the object means that it has very realistic representation. Like on the left side, it's very realistic the way you depict a face. It's similar, very, very iconic. But as you go this way, become more abstract, you get essential features of a face until you reach the smiley. That means it's closer to the interpretant. Because the point of having a smiley face is to make you sure that someone expressing that emotion, right? I'm not going to the plain thing because this is more like the representation closer to the representation itself. It's mindfuck. If a representation becomes closer to a representation itself, you get abstract symbols because the abstract symbols represent the representation. They are the building blocks of representations.
Yeah, like you have Mickey Mouse, which represents a mouse, and then you have three circles that represent Mickey Mouse. So it's
yes, exactly. And then it becomes a representation of a representation. Then it becomes on this side. But the most important lesson is an object representation can be very realistic or can be very abstract. And if it's abstract, it might have more meaning than actually being realistic. That's definitely another contradiction. If something is more realistic, it conveys less meaning than if it's less realistic. Because meaning is not constructed from reality. Actually, reality is constructed out of meaning. Well, I think it's enough for you guys. Let's have a break, right? You need a break. I can see you that. All right. 15, go to the exercise. But first, let's make it clear. The way you manipulate a representation will never determine the interpretant. You cannot use semiotics to guarantee that people will understand what you want or people will do what you want them to do. So it's not a kind of mind control theory for using for mass communication, because the object is dynamic. Sometimes the science represents something, sometimes it represents something else. And you have to accept this. That's the contradiction of representation and reality we're talking about. What can you do then to cope with that contradiction? Well, you can, instead of right away drawing the icon, you can draw the parameters. Define what are the parameters of this icon before I draw it. And then you try different kind of options within those parameters. And it does not look like that, but the Susan Kerr, she was doing that in the project of Macintosh icons. The parameters are drawn into the page itself. So the icon is based on pixels, and she used a squared notebook to draw them. And nobody had thought about doing that before. People were just drawing icons directly on the computer, but she was making sketches of different versions of those icons on the sketchbook to see how they would represent, if they would be a good representation to that particular object, to consider different possibilities. This is kind of a meta design structure that designers use to organize their designs in a very informal way, but very effective. Sometimes it's not perceived as a system, but it is a system for generating ideas. The second one, as I already mentioned, generate alternatives to find potential object representations. So here you see that a guy who made a VLC icon, he drew a lot of options for each icon of the configuration interface. And he was not going for the first idea. The cone, yeah. What is the relationship between the representation and the object.
Yeah.
It's probably just a symbol, as Doria was telling us before. It's just a symbol. It's just a strange, very distinctive object that you can relate to a software, a specific software. And if you repeat that many times, then you get that, you get it. Maybe there is another reason, but in the pragmatics of our context, it has no connection, I see, as I see, the object and the representation. And the third suggestion is test with users. Check if the user understands what your icons are supposed to mean. And I developed a method called icon sorting, where I show an icon. This is the application of this method on the left side. I show an icon for 13 seconds. The icon is on top left. The countdown is telling that there's only 8 seconds left for you to decide which label of this fits better that icon. And if you do not click, then you do not understand what the icon means. So it's a bad icon. So if you right away choose this one, then it's a good association between the label, the object, and the icon. And I tested how many people. I tested with many people, and I saw the degree of agreement. So recursives are really well represented by this icon. And hot sites are also well represented by a fire icon. But links is very badly represented by, I don't know what the hell I had in mind when I drew this.
But it's mechanical.
Yeah, it's a mechanical link, but no, people do not understand.
Yeah.
Programming also, strange. And what is this?
It's a tie.
It is a tie? All right. No many people can see that. But I only a tie?
Is a shirt with
yeah,
a tie.
Yeah, yeah.
A shirt with a tie.
Fish.
You saw a fish?
I saw a fish. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Not mostly, but
a lot of people see different things.
Tie,
this looks like the Carrefour logo, right? There is a C in the Carrefour logo, but many people do not see the C because the C is in the it's like in the white space. It's written with the white space.
But after you see, you can't.
You cannot see any longer. You cannot not see any longer. You're right. So the best way to design a new icon is most of the times not doing it. So it's better if you copy an icon, if that icon has already the status of a symbol in a particular culture, instead of creating a new one. Otherwise, people will not associate the object with the representation. Of course, you can do that if you are a free software like VLC. They do not care so much because they may afford waiting many years to become known. But if you really want to have a good app that people right away start using and with a lot of users, you might choose to grab some existing icons. These are some of the libraries I know that where you can download and use icons with a royalty-free license. It's quite easy to get them. Some of them are even Creative Commons. However, even the most symbolic icons are subject to the contradiction of representation and reality. And the funniest example of this contradiction, corroding, destroying the association of that representation, is the save icon. Yes. So the, old guy like you, as old as you are, comes to a kid and say, "Hey, kid, have you seen one of these before?" And then you show the disc to the kid, and you know what a disc is because you have used discs or you saw discs. But then the child is saying, "Cool, you made a 3D model of the save icon." So for the kid, the save icon, the object of the save icon, is definitely the save computing concept. And he does not have any relationship between the save concept and the disk, the physical disk. But this symbol stick to us and we are still using, but it's gradually fading away, especially because of auto-saving apps like online Google Google Drive. Yeah. Google Drive does not have a save icon sometimes for a long time. Right. But in the beginning it had. At the very beginning it had, because people were worried about pressing save all the time. So you might like this example, Doria. That's exactly what you were talking of before, right?
You got too far from the creation.
Right? Mm-hmm. So if you use symbolic icons, does not mean, or an icon that already exists, does not mean people will understand. We had an exercise for playing the concept game, but unfortunately we don't have enough time for that. But I really recommend you, if you want to get better and good at creating or in choosing icons for your interface, this game is definitely great for that. It's easy to find. It's also publishing in Portuguese, so you can buy it. And unfortunately, we don't have time for that. We're going to exercise creating icons, right? But creating icons depends on this kind of skills of being creative on associating objects to representations, and that's exactly what the kind of skills that you develop by playing this game. All right, our exercise will be more applied to something closer to HCI. You will have first to create 10 user stories for an internet banking application using the template. User stories is a method used in agile development to grab user requirements in a non-bureaucratic way. So you give some small piece of papers to a user, or you ask the user to tell you in that format what the user would want, or either you put yourself into the shoes of the user and think, what would I do if I was a user of this type? So as a type of user, I want some goal for, or so that, some reason. So for example, as a teacher, I want to check the grades of my students so that I can tell them who is approved in this course or not. So here you see the goal, and here you see the consequences of reaching that goal, or the desdobramentos, the unfolding actions that happens after you reach the goal. And that's a structure for requirements on developing a software. I really like this method, and I think it's quite user-centered. And we're going to use this to create icons. So after you finish writing your user stories, you will start making icons. But making, not drawing? Yes, making. Because I know that most of you might say, oh, teacher, I don't draw very well, I'm bad with that, I don't like... Don't worry, it's not about drawing, it's about finding an representation that you already know, or you might create a new representation that fit the object you want to convey. And for example, objects that you might want to convey are this kind of functions, that the functionality you want to provide so that this user story is a happy story. For example, if I wanted to check the grades, your icon would show kind of a grades, a grade book somehow, right? So that functionality will fulfill my goal.
Check. I can use glasses or maybe
a binocular. Yeah. You can have multiple representations. You do not need to be accurate in your representation. You just need to convey a meaning. And because I want you to focus on meaning and not on the quality of your representation, I will give you clay, not pencil and paper. Because I know some people are really good with pencil, some people are really bad. But everybody's bad with clay. So, yeah, nobody is good with modeling with clay. No, it's not argila. I will give you massinha de modelar. All right? And then after you do that, you will test. You will test the meaning. So you will only show the icons to another group, and you will have to write down what each icon means. And you would compare what you wanted to convey and what actually people understood. It's similar to the card sorting exercise we did last class, all right? So let's make some groups and start doing the exercise.
Groups of